cloaking its potent truth in a metaphorical language of symbols, myth, and allegory. To this day, this encrypted wisdom is all around us, encoded in our mythology, our art, and the occult texts of the ages. Unfortunately, modern man has lost the ability to decipher this complex network of symbolism, and the great truth has been lost. Solomon waited. That's all? The girl shifted in her seat. Actually, there is a little bit more. I should hope so. Please, tell us. The girl looked hesitant, but she cleared her throat and continued. According to legend, the sages who encrypted the ancient mysteries long ago left behind a key of sorts, a password that could be used to unlock the encrypted secrets. This magical password, known as the Verbum Significatium, is said to hold the power to lift the darkness and unlock the ancient mysteries, opening them to all human understanding. Solomon smiled wistfully. Ah, yes, the Verbum Significatium. He stared into space for a moment, and then lowered his eyes again to the blonde girl. And where is this wonderful word now? The girl looked apprehensive, clearly wishing she had not challenged their guest speaker. She finished reading. Legend holds that the Verbum Significatium is buried deep underground where it waits patiently for a pivotal moment in history, a moment when mankind can no longer survive without the truth, knowledge, and wisdom of the ages. At this dark crossroads, mankind will at last unearth the word and herald in a wondrous new age of enlightenment. The girl turned off her phone and shrank down in her seat. After a long silence, another student raised his hand. Mr. Solomon, you don't actually believe that, right? Solomon smiled. Why not? Our mythologies have a long tradition of magic words that provide insight and godlike powers. To this day, children still shout abracadabra in hopes of creating something out of nothing. Of course, we've all forgotten that this word is not a toy. It has roots in ancient Aramaic mysticism, avracadabra, meaning, I create as I speak. Silence. But sir, the student now pressed, surely you don't believe that a single word, this verbum significatium, whatever it is, has the power to unlock ancient wisdom and bring about a worldwide enlightenment? Peter Solomon's face revealed nothing. My own beliefs should not concern you. What should concern you is that this prophecy of a coming enlightenment is echoed in virtually every faith and philosophical tradition on earth. Hindus call it the Krita Age. Astrologers call it the Age of Aquarius. The Jews describe the coming of the Messiah. Theosophists call it the New Age. Cosmologists call it harmonic convergence and predict the actual date. December 21st, 2012, someone called. Yes. Unnervingly soon, if you're a believer in Mayan math. Langdon chuckled, recalling how Solomon, 10 years ago, had correctly predicted the current spate of television specials predicting that the year 2012 would mark the end of the world. Timing aside, Solomon said, I find it wondrous to note that throughout history, all of mankind's disparate philosophies have all concurred on one thing, that a great enlightenment is coming. In every culture, in every era, in every corner of the world, the human dream has focused on the same exact concept, the coming apotheosis of man, the impending transformation of our human minds into their true potentiality. He smiled. What could possibly explain such a synchronicity of beliefs? Truth, said a quiet voice in the crowd. Solomon wheeled. Who said that? The hand that went up belonged to a tiny Asian boy, whose soft features suggested he might be Nepalese or Tibetan. Maybe there is a universal truth embedded in everyone's soul. Maybe we all have the same story hiding inside, like a shared constant in our DNA. Maybe this collective truth is responsible for the similarity in all of our stories. Solomon was beaming as he pressed his hands together and bowed reverently to the boy. Thank you. Everyone was quiet. Truth, Solomon said, addressing the room. Truth has power. And if we all gravitate toward similar ideas, maybe we do so because those ideas are true, written deep within us. And when we hear the truth, even if we don't understand it, we feel that truth resonate within us, vibrating with our unconscious wisdom. Perhaps the truth is not learned by us, but rather the truth is recalled, remembered, recognized as that which is already inside us. The silence in the hall was complete. Solomon let it sit for a long moment, then quietly said, "In closing, I should warn you that unveiling the truth is never easy. Throughout history, every period of enlightenment has been accompanied by darkness pushing in opposition. Such are the laws of nature and balance. And if we look at the darkness growing in the world today, we have to realize that this means there is equal light growing. We are on the verge of a truly great period of illumination, and all of us, all of you, are profoundly blessed to be living through this pivotal moment of history. Of all the people who have ever lived, in all the eras in history, we are in that narrow window of time during which we will bear witness to our ultimate renaissance. After millennia of darkness, we will see our sciences, our minds, and even our religions unveil the truth." Solomon was about to get a hearty round of applause when he held up his hand for silence. "Miss," he pointed directly to the contentious blonde girl in back with the cell phone. "I know you and I didn't agree on much, but I want to thank you. Your passion is an important catalyst in the coming changes. Darkness feeds on apathy, and conviction is our most potent antidote. Keep studying your faith. Study the Bible," he smiled, "especially the final pages." "The Apocalypse?" she said. "Absolutely. The book of Revelation is a vibrant example of our shared truth. The last book of the Bible tells the identical story as countless other traditions. They all predict the coming unveiling of great wisdom." Someone else said, "But isn't the Apocalypse about the end of the world? You know, the Antichrist, Armageddon, the final battle between good and evil?" Solomon chuckled. "Who here studies Greek?" Several hands went up. "What does the word apocalypse literally mean?" "It means," one student began, and then paused as if surprised, "apocalypse means to unveil, or to reveal." Solomon gave the boy a nod of approval. "Exactly. The apocalypse is literally a revelation. The book of revelation in the Bible predicts an unveiling of great truth and unimaginable wisdom. The apocalypse is not the end of the world, but rather it is the end of the world as we know it. The prophecy of the apocalypse is just one of the Bible's beautiful messages that has been distorted." Solomon stepped to the front of the stage. "Believe me, the apocalypse is coming, and it will be nothing like what we were taught." High over his head, the bell began to toll. The students erupted into bewildered and thunderous applause. Chapter 112. Catherine Solomon was teetering on the edge of consciousness when she was jolted by the shockwave of a deafening explosion. Moments later, she smelled smoke. Her ears were ringing. There were muffled voices, distant, shouting, footsteps. Suddenly, she was breathing more clearly. The cloth had been pulled from her mouth. "You're safe," a man's voice whispered. "Just hold on." She expected the man to pull the needle out of her arm, but instead he was yelling orders. "Bring the medical kit. Attach an IV to the needle. Infuse lactated Ringer's solution. Get me a blood pressure." As the man began checking her vital signs, he said, "Miss Solomon, the person who did this to you, where did he go?" Catherine tried to speak, but she could not. "Miss Solomon," the voice repeated, "where did he go?" Catherine tried to pry her eyes open, but she felt herself fading. "We need to know where he went," the man urged. Catherine whispered three words in response, although she knew they made no sense.
"The sacred mountain."
Director Sato stepped over the mangled steel door and descended a wooden ramp into the hidden basement. One of her agents met her at the bottom. "Director, I think you'll want to see this." Sato followed the agent into a small room off the narrow hallway. The room was brightly lit and barren, except for a pile of clothing on the floor. She recognized Robert Langdon's tweed coat and loafers. Her agent pointed toward the far wall at a large casket-like container.
"What in the world?"
Sato moved toward the container, seeing now that it was fed by a clear plastic pipe that ran through the wall. Warily, she approached the tank. Now she could see that it had a small slider on top. She reached down and slid the covering to one side, revealing a small portal-like window. Sato recoiled. Beneath the plexiglass floated the submerged, vacant face of Professor Robert Langdon.
Light!
The endless void in which Langdon hovered was suddenly filled by a blinding sun. Rays of white-hot light streamed across the blackness of space, burning into his mind. The light was everywhere. Suddenly, within the radiant cloud before him, a beautiful silhouette appeared. It was a face, blurry and indistinct. Two eyes staring at him across the void. Streams of light surrounded the face, and Langdon wondered if he was looking into the face of God. Sato stared down into the tank, wondering if Professor Langdon had any idea what had happened. She doubted it. After all, disorientation was the entire purpose of this technology. Sensory deprivation tanks had been around since the 50s, and were still a popular getaway for wealthy New Age experimenters. Floating, as it was called, offered a transcendental back-to-the-womb experience, a kind of meditative aid that quieted brain activity by removing all sensory input, light, sound, touch, and even the pull of gravity. In traditional tanks, the person would float on his back in a hyperbuoyant saline solution that kept his face above the water so he could breathe. In recent years, however, these tanks had taken a quantum leap. Oxygenated perfluorocarbons. This new technology, known as total liquid ventilation, TLV, was so counterintuitive that few believed it existed. Breathable liquid. Liquid breathing had been a reality since 1966, when Leland C. Clark successfully kept alive a mouse that had been submerged for several hours in an oxygenated perfluorocarbon. In 1989, TLV technology made a dramatic appearance in the movie The Abyss, although few viewers realized that they were watching real science. Total liquid ventilation had been born of modern medicine's attempts to help premature babies breathe by returning them to the liquid-filled state of the womb. Human lungs, having spent 9 months in utero, were no strangers to a liquid-filled state. Perfluorocarbons had once been too viscous to be fully breathable, but modern breakthroughs had made breathable liquids almost the consistency of water. The CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, the Wizards of Langley as they were known within the intelligence community, had worked extensively with oxygenated perfluorocarbons to develop technologies for the U.S. military. The Navy's elite deep ocean diving teams found breathing oxygenated liquid rather than the usual Heliox or Trimix gave them the ability to dive to much greater depths without risk of pressure sickness. Similarly, NASA and the Air Force had learned that pilots equipped with a liquid breathing apparatus rather than a traditional oxygen tank could withstand far higher G-forces than usual because liquid spread the G-force more evenly throughout the internal organs than gas did. Sato had heard that there were now extreme experience labs where one could try these total liquid ventilation tanks, meditation machines, as they were called. This particular tank had probably been installed for its owner's private experimentation, although the addition of heavy lockable latches left little doubt in Sato's mind that this tank had also been used for darker applications, an interrogation technique with which the CIA was familiar. The infamous interrogation technique of waterboarding was highly effective because the victim truly believed he was drowning. Sato knew of several classified operations in which sensory deprivation tanks like these had been used to enhance that illusion to terrifying new levels. A victim submerged in breathable liquid could literally be drowned. The panic associated with the drowning experience usually made the victim unaware that the liquid he was breathing was slightly more viscous than water. When the liquid poured into his lungs, he would often black out from fear, and then awaken in the ultimate solitary confinement. Topical numbing agents, paralysis drugs, and hallucinogens were mixed with the warm, oxygenated liquid to give the prisoner the sense he was entirely separated from his body. When his mind sent commands to move his limbs, nothing happened. The state of being dead was terrifying on its own, but the true disorientation came from the rebirthing process, which, with the aid of bright lights, cold air, and deafening noise, could be extremely traumatic and painful. After a handful of rebirths and subsequent drownings, the prisoner became so disorientated that he had no idea if he was alive or dead, and he would tell the interrogator absolutely anything. Sato wondered if she should wait for a medical team to extract Langdon, but she knew she didn't have time.
"I need to know what he knows." "Turn out the lights," she said, "and find me some blankets."
The blinding sun had vanished. The face had also disappeared. The blackness had returned. But Langdon could now hear distant whispers echoing across the light years of emptiness. Muffled voices, unintelligible words. There were vibrations now, as if the world were about to shake apart. Then it happened. Without warning, the universe was ripped in two. An enormous chasm opened in the void, as if space itself had ruptured at the seams. A grayish mist poured through the opening, and Langdon saw a terrifying sight. Disembodied hands were suddenly reaching for him, grabbing his body, trying to yank him out of his world.
"No!"
He tried to fight them off, but he had no arms, no fists. Or did he? Suddenly he felt his body materializing around his mind. His flesh had returned, and it was being seized by powerful hands that were dragging him upward.
"No, please!"
But it was too late. Pain racked his chest as the hands heaved him through the opening. His lungs felt like they were filled with sand.
"I can't breathe."
He was suddenly on his back on the coldest, hardest surface he could imagine. Something was pressing on his chest, over and over, hard and painful. He was spewing out the warmth.
"I want to go back."
He felt like he was a child being born from a womb. He was convulsing, coughing up liquid. He felt pain in his chest and neck, excruciating pain. His throat was on fire. People were talking, trying to whisper, but it was deafening. His vision was blurred and all he could see was muted shapes. His skin felt numb like dead leather. His chest felt heavier now.
Pressure. "I can't breathe."
He was coughing up more liquid. An overwhelming gag reflex seized him, and he gasped inward. Cold air poured into his lungs, and he felt like a newborn taking his first breath on Earth. This world was excruciating. All Langdon wanted was to return to the womb. Robert Langdon had no idea how much time had passed. He could feel now that he was lying on his side, wrapped in towels and blankets on a hard floor. A familiar face was gazing down at him, but the streams of glorious light were gone. The echoes of distant chanting still hung in his mind. Verbum significatium, verbum omnificum.
"Professor Langdon,"
someone whispered.
"Do you know where you are?"
Langdon nodded weakly, still coughing. More important, he had begun to realize what was going on tonight. Chapter 113. Wrapped in wool blankets, Langdon stood on wobbly legs and stared down at the open tank of liquid. His body had returned to him, although he wished it had not. His throat and lungs burned. This world felt hard and cruel. Sato had just explained the sensory deprivation tank, adding that if she had not pulled him out, he would have died of starvation or worse. Langdon had little doubt that Peter had endured a similar experience. "Peter is in the in-between," the tattooed man had told him earlier tonight. "He is in purgatory. Hamistagen. If Peter had endured more than one of those birthing processes, Langdon would not have been surprised if Peter had told his captor anything he had wanted to know. Sato motioned for Langdon to follow her, and he did, trudging slowly down a narrow hall, deeper into this bizarre lair that he was now seeing for the first time. They entered a square room with a stone table and eerie colored lighting. Catherine was here, and Langdon heaved a sigh of relief. Even so, the scene was worrisome. Catherine was lying on her back on a stone table. Blood-soaked towels lay on the floor. A CIA agent was holding an IV bag above her, the tube connected to her arm. She was sobbing quietly.
"Catherine,"
Langdon croaked, barely able to speak. She turned her head, looking disorientated and confused.
"Robert?"
Her eyes widened with disbelief and then joy.
"But I saw you drown."
He moved toward the stone table. Catherine pulled herself to a seated position, ignoring her IV tube and the medical objections of the agent. Langdon reached the table, and Catherine reached out, wrapping her arms around his blanket-clad body, holding him close.
"Thank God,"
she whispered, kissing his cheek. Then she kissed him again, squeezing him as though she didn't believe he was real.
"I don't understand. How?"
Sato began saying something about sensory deprivation tanks and oxygenated perfluorocarbons. But Catherine clearly wasn't listening. She just held Langdon close.
"Robert," she said, "Peter's alive."
Her voice wavered as she recounted her horrifying reunion with Peter. She described his physical condition, the wheelchair, the strange knife, the allusions to some kind of sacrifice, and how she had been left bleeding as a human hourglass to persuade Peter to cooperate quickly. Langdon could barely speak.
"Do you have any idea where they went?"
"He said he was taking Peter to the sacred mountain."
Langdon pulled away and stared at her. Catherine had tears in her eyes.
"He said he had deciphered the grid on the bottom of the pyramid, and that the pyramid told him to go to the sacred mountain."
"Professor,"
Sato pressed,
"does that mean anything to you?"
Langdon shook his head.
"Not at all."
Still, he felt a surge of hope.
"But if he got the information off the bottom of the pyramid, we can get it too."
"I told him how to solve it." Sato shook her head.
"The pyramid's gone. We've looked. He took it with him."
Langdon remained silent a moment, closing his eyes and trying to recall what he had seen on the base of the pyramid. The grid of symbols had been one of the last images he had seen before drowning, and trauma had a way of burning memories deeper into the mind. He could recall some of the grid. Definitely not all of it. But maybe enough? He turned to Sato and said hurriedly,
"I may be able to remember enough, but I need you to look up something on the internet."
She pulled out her BlackBerry.
"Run a search for the Order 8 Franklin Square."
Sato gave him a startled look, but began typing without questions. Langdon's vision was still blurry, and he was only now starting to process his strange surroundings. He realized that the stone table on which they were leaning was covered with old bloodstains, and the wall to his right was entirely plastered with pages of text, photos, drawings, maps, and a giant web of strings interconnecting them.
"My God."
Langdon moved toward the strange collage, still clutching the blankets around his body. Tacked on the wall was an utterly bizarre collection of information. Pages from ancient texts, ranging from black magic to Christian scripture. Drawings of symbols and sigils. Pages of conspiracy theory websites, and satellite photos of Washington, D.C., scrawled with notes and question marks. One of the sheets was a long list of words in many languages. He recognized some of them as sacred Masonic words, others as ancient magic words, and others from ceremonial incantations. Is that what he's looking for? A word? Is it that simple? Langdon's long-standing skepticism about the Masonic pyramid was based largely on what it allegedly revealed, the location of the ancient mysteries. This discovery would have to involve an enormous vault filled with thousands upon thousands of volumes
that had somehow survived the long-lost ancient libraries in which they had once been stored. It all seemed impossible. A vault that big? Beneath D.C.? Now, however, his recollection of Peter's lecture at Phillips Exeter, combined with these lists of magic words, had opened another startling possibility. Langdon most definitely did not believe in the power of magic words, and yet it seemed pretty clear that the tattooed man did. His pulse quickened as he again scanned the scrawled notes, the maps, the texts, the printouts, and all the interconnected strings and sticky notes. Sure enough, there was one recurring theme. My God, he's looking for the verbum significatium, the lost word. Langdon let the thought take shape, recalling fragments of Peter's lecture. The lost word is what he's looking for. That's what he believes is buried here in Washington. Sato arrived beside him.
Is this what you asked for?
She handed him her BlackBerry. Langdon looked at the 8x8 grid of numbers on the screen. Exactly. He grabbed a piece of scrap paper. I'll need a pen. Sato handed him one from her pocket.
Please, hurry.
Inside the basement office of the Directorate of Science and Technology, Nola Kay was once again studying the redacted document brought to her by SysSec Rick Parrish. What the hell is the CIA director doing with a file about ancient pyramids and secret underground locations? She grabbed the phone and dialed. Sato answered instantly, sounding tense.
Nola, I was just about to call you.
I have new information, Nola said. I'm not sure how this fits, but I've discovered there's a redacted...
Forget it, whatever it is,
Sato interrupted.
We're out of time. We failed to apprehend the target, and I have every reason to believe he's about to carry out his threat.
Nola felt a chill.
The good news is, we know exactly where he's going.
Sato took a deep breath.
The bad news is that he's carrying a laptop with him.
Chapter 114. Less than 10 miles away, Malak tucked the blanket around Peter Solomon and wheeled him across a moonlit parking lot into the shadow of an enormous building. The structure had exactly 33 outer columns, each precisely 33 feet tall. The mountainous structure was deserted at this hour, and nobody would ever see them back here. Not that it mattered. From a distance, no one would think twice about a tall, kindly-looking man in a long black coat, taking a bald invalid for an evening stroll. When they reached the rear entrance, Malak wheeled Peter up close to the security keypad. Peter stared at it defiantly, clearly having no intention of entering the code. Malak laughed.
You think you're here to let me in? Have you forgotten so soon that I am one of your brethren?
He reached out and typed the access code that he had been given after his initiation to the 33rd degree. The heavy door clicked open. Peter groaned and began struggling in the wheelchair.
Peter, Peter,
Malak cooed.
Picture Catherine. Be cooperative and she will live. You can save her. I give you my word.
Malak wheeled his captive inside and relocked the door behind them, his heart racing now with anticipation. He pushed Peter through some hallways to an elevator and pressed the call button. The doors opened, and Malak backed in, pulling the wheelchair along with him. Then, making sure Peter could see what he was doing, he reached out and pressed the uppermost button. A look of deepening dread crossed Peter's tortured face.
Shh.
Malak whispered, gently stroking Peter's shaved head as the elevator doors closed.
As you well know, the secret is how to die.
I can't remember all the symbols. Langdon closed his eyes, doing his best to recall the precise locations of the symbols on the bottom of the stone pyramid. But even his eidetic memory did not have that degree of recall. He wrote down the few symbols he could remember, placing each one in the location indicated by Franklin's magic square. So far, however, he saw nothing that made any sense.
Look, Catherine urged, you must be on the right track. The first row is all Greek letters.
The same kinds of symbols are being arranged together.
Langdon had noticed this too, but he could not think of any Greek word that fit that configuration of letters and spaces.
I need the first letter.
He glanced again at the magic square, trying to recall the letter that had been in the number one spot near the lower left corner.
Think.
He closed his eyes, trying to picture the base of the pyramid.
The bottom row, next to the left-hand corner. What letter was there?
For an instant, Langdon was back in the tank, racked with terror, staring up through the plexiglass at the bottom of the pyramid. Now suddenly he saw it. He opened his eyes, breathing heavily.
The first letter is H.
Langdon turned back to the grid and wrote in the first letter. The word was still incomplete, but he had seen enough. Suddenly he realized what the word might be.
Herodon.
Pulse pounding, Langdon typed a new search into the BlackBerry. He entered the English equivalent of this well-known Greek word. The first hit that appeared was an encyclopedia entry. He read it and knew it had to be right. Herodon. Noun. A significant word in high-degree Freemasonry. From French Rose Croix rituals, where it refers to a mythical mountain in Scotland. The legendary site of the first such chapter. From the Greek Herodon, originating from Hieros Domos, Greek for holy house.
That's it, Langdon exclaimed, incredulous. That's where they went.
Sato had been reading over his shoulder and looked lost.
To a mythical mountain in Scotland?
Langdon shook his head. No. To a building in Washington whose code name is Herodon. Chapter 115. The house of the temple, known among its brethren as Herodon, had always been the crown jewel of the Masonic Scottish Rite in America. With its steeply sloped pyramidical roof, the building was named for an imaginary Scottish mountain. Moloch knew, however, there was nothing imaginary about the treasure hidden here.
This is the place, he knew. The Masonic pyramid has shown the way.
As the old elevator slowly made its way to the third floor, Moloch took out the piece of paper on which he had reorganized the grid of symbols using the Franklin Square. All the Greek letters had now shifted to the first row, along with one simple symbol, a downward-facing arrow. The message could not have been more clear. Beneath the house of the temple, Herodon, downward arrow.
The lost word is here, somewhere.
Although Moloch did not know precisely how to locate it, he was confident that the answer lay in the remaining symbols on the grid. Conveniently, when it came to unlocking the secrets of the Masonic pyramid and of this building, no one was more qualified to help than Peter Solomon,
the worshipful master himself.
Peter continued to struggle in the wheelchair, making muffled sounds through his gag.
I know you're worried about Catherine,
Moloch said,
but it's almost over.
For Moloch, the end felt like it had arrived very suddenly. After all the years of pain and planning, waiting and searching, the moment had now arrived. The elevator began to slow, and he felt a rush of excitement. The carriage jolted to a stop. The bronze doors slid open, and Moloch gazed out at the glorious chamber before them. The massive square room was adorned with symbols and bathed in moonlight, which shone down through the oculus at the pinnacle of the ceiling high above.
I have come full circle, Moloch thought.
The temple room was the same place in which Peter Solomon and his brethren had so foolishly initiated Moloch as one of their own. Now the Mason's most sublime secret, something that most of the brethren did not even believe existed, was about to be unearthed. He won't find anything, Langdon said, still feeling groggy and disorientated as he followed Sato and the others up the wooden ramp out of the basement. There is no actual word. It's all a metaphor, a symbol of the ancient mysteries. Catherine followed, with two agents assisting her weakened body up the ramp. As the group moved gingerly through the wreckage of the steel door, through the rotating painting, and into the living room, Langdon explained to Sato that the lost word was one of Freemasonry's most enduring symbols. A single word, written in an arcane language,
that man could no longer decipher. The word, like the mysteries themselves, promised to unveil its hidden power only to those enlightened enough to decrypt it. It is said, Langdon concluded, that if you can possess and understand the lost word, then the ancient mysteries will become clear to you. Sato glanced over.
So you believe this man is looking for a word?
Langdon had to admit it sounded absurd at face value, and yet it answered a lot of questions. Look, I'm no specialist in ceremonial magic, he said, but from the documents on his basement walls, and from Catherine's description of the untattooed flesh on his head, I'd say he's hoping to find the lost word and inscribe it on his body. Sato moved the group toward the dining room. Outside, the helicopter was warming up, its blades thundering louder and louder. Langdon kept talking, thinking aloud. If this guy truly believes he is about to unlock the power of the ancient mysteries, no symbol would be more potent in his mind than the lost word. If he could find it and inscribe it on the top of his head, a sacred location in itself, then he would no doubt consider himself perfectly adorned and ritualistically prepared to... He paused, seeing Catherine blanch at the thought of Peter's impending fate.
But Robert, she said weakly, her voice barely audible over the helicopter blades. This is good news, right? If he wants to inscribe the lost word on the top of his head before he sacrifices Peter, then we have time. He won't kill Peter until he finds the word. And if there is no word...
Langdon tried to look hopeful as the agents helped Catherine into a chair. Unfortunately, Peter still thinks you're bleeding to death. He thinks the only way to save you is to cooperate with this lunatic, probably to help him find the lost word.
So what? She insisted. If the word doesn't exist...
Catherine, Langdon said, staring deeply into her eyes. If I believed you were dying, and if someone promised me I could save you by finding the lost word, then I would find this man a word, any word, and then I'd pray to God he kept his promise. Director Sato? An agent shouted from the next room. You'd better see this. Sato hurried out of the dining room and saw one of her agents coming down the stairs from the bedroom. He was carrying a blonde wig.
What the hell?
Man's hairpiece, he said, handing it to her. Found it in the dressing room. Have a close look. The blonde wig was much heavier than Sato expected. The skullcap seemed to be molded of a thick gel. Strangely, the underside of the wig had a wire protruding from it. Gel-pack battery that molds to your scalp, the agent said. Powers a fiber-optic pinpoint camera hidden in the hair.
What?
Sato felt around with her fingers until she found the tiny camera lens nestled invisibly within the blonde bangs.
This thing's a hidden camera?
Video camera, the agent said. Stores footage on this tiny solid-state card. He pointed to a stamp-sized square of silicon embedded in the skullcap. Probably motion-activated.
Jesus, she thought. So that's how he did it.
This sleek version of the flower-in-the-lapel secret camera had played a key role in the crisis the OS director was facing tonight. She glared at it a moment longer, and then handed it back to the agent.
Keep searching the house, she said. I want every bit of information you can find on this guy. We know his laptop is missing, and I want to know exactly how he plans to connect it to the outside world while he's on the move. Search his study for manuals, cables, anything at all that might give us a clue about his hardware.
Yes, ma'am. The agent hurried off. Time to move out. Sato could hear the whine of the helicopter blades at full pitch. She hurried back to the dining room, where Simpkins had now ushered Warren Bellamy in from the helicopter, and was gathering intel from him about the building to which they believed their target had gone. House of the Temple.
The front doors are sealed from within, Bellamy was saying, still wrapped in a foil blanket and shivering visibly from his time outside in Franklin Square. The building's rear entrance is your only way in. It's got a keypad with an access pin known only to the brothers. What's the pin? Simpkins demanded, taking notes.
Bellamy sat down, looking too feeble to stand. Through chattering teeth, he recited his access code and then added,
The address is 1733 16th. but you'll want the access drive and parking area behind the building. Kind of tricky to find, but I know exactly where it is, Langdon said. I'll show you when we get there. Simpkins shook his head. You're not coming, Professor. This is a military— The hell I'm not, Langdon fired back. Peter's in there, and that building's a labyrinth. Without someone to lead you in, you'll take 10 minutes to find your way up to the temple room.
He's right, Bellamy said. It's a maze. There is an elevator, but it's old and loud, and opens in full view of the temple room. If you hope to move in quietly, you'll need to ascend on foot.
You'll never find your way, Langdon warned. From that rear entrance, you're navigating through the Hall of Regalia, the Hall of Honor, the Middle Landing, the Atrium, the Grand Stair.
Enough,
Sato said.
Langdon's coming.
Chapter 116. The energy was growing. Malak could feel it pulsing within him, moving up and down his body as he wheeled Peter Solomon toward the altar.
I will exit this building infinitely more powerful than when I entered. All that remained now was to locate the final ingredient.
Verbum significatium,
he whispered to himself.
Verbum omnificum.
Malak parked Peter's wheelchair beside the altar, and then circled around and unzipped the heavy day bag that sat on Peter's lap. Reaching inside, he lifted out the stone pyramid and held it up in the moonlight, directly in front of Peter's eyes, showing him the grid of symbols engraved on the bottom.
All these years, he taunted, and you never knew how the pyramid kept her secrets.
Malak set the pyramid carefully on the corner of the altar and returned to the bag.
And this talisman,
he continued, extracting the golden capstone,
did indeed bring order from chaos, exactly as promised.
He placed the metal capstone carefully atop the stone pyramid, and then stepped back to give Peter a clear view.
Behold, your symbolon is complete.
Peter's face contorted, and he tried in vain to speak.
Good. I can see you have something you'd like to tell me.
Malak roughly yanked out the gag. Peter Solomon coughed and gasped for several seconds before he finally managed to speak.
Catherine's time is short. If you want to save her, I suggest you do exactly as I say.
Malak suspected she was probably already dead, or if not, very close. It made no difference. She was lucky to have lived long enough to say goodbye to her brother.
Please,
Peter begged, his voice ragged.
Send an ambulance for her. I will do exactly that. But first you must tell me how to access the secret staircase.
Peter's expression turned to one of disbelief.
What? The staircase. Masonic legend speaks of stairs that descend hundreds of feet to the secret location where the lost word is buried.
Peter now looked panicked.
You know the legend, Malak baited. A secret staircase hidden beneath a stone.
He pointed to the central altar, a huge block of granite with a gilded inscription in Hebrew. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
Obviously, this is the right place. The entrance to the staircase must be hidden on one of the floors beneath us.
There is no secret staircase in this building, Peter shouted.
Malak smiled patiently and motioned upward.
This building is shaped like a pyramid.
He pointed to the four-sided vaulted ceiling that angled up to the square oculus in the center.
Yes, the house of the temple is a pyramid, but what does—
Peter, I have all night.
Malak smoothed his white silk robe over his perfect body.
Catherine, however, does not. If you want her to live, you will tell me how to access the staircase.
I already told you, he declared. There is no secret staircase in this building.
No?
Malak calmly produced the sheet of paper on which he had reorganized the grid of symbols from the base of the pyramid.
This is the Masonic pyramid's final message. Your friend Robert Langdon helped me decipher it.
Malak raised the paper and held it in front of Peter's eyes. The worshipful master inhaled sharply when he saw it. Not only had the 64 symbols been organized into clearly meaningful groups, but an actual image
had materialized out of the chaos. An image of a staircase beneath a pyramid. Peter Solomon stared in disbelief at the grid of symbols before him. The Masonic pyramid had kept its secret for generations. Now, suddenly, it was being unveiled, and he felt a cold sense of foreboding in the pit of his stomach. The pyramid's final code. At a glance, the true meaning of these symbols remained a mystery to Peter, and yet he could immediately understand why the tattooed man believed what he believed.
He thinks there is a hidden staircase beneath the pyramid called Herodom. He misunderstands these symbols.
The 64 symbols now seemed to have an order. A pyramid had formed with a staircase beneath it.
Where is it?
The tattooed man demanded.
Tell me how to find the staircase and I will save Catherine.
I wish I could do that, Peter thought. But the staircase is not real. The myth of the staircase was purely symbolic. Part of the great allegories of masonry. The winding staircase, as it was known, appeared on the second-degree tracing boards. It represented man's intellectual climb toward the divine truth. Like Jacob's ladder, the winding staircase was a symbol of the pathway to heaven, the journey of man toward God, the connection between the earthly and spiritual realms. Its steps represented the many virtues of the mind.
He should know that, Peter thought.
He endured all the initiations. Every Masonic initiate learned of the symbolic staircase that he could ascend, enabling him to participate in the mysteries of human science. Freemasonry, like noetic science and the ancient mysteries, revered the untapped potential of the human mind, and many of Masonry's symbols related to human physiology. The mind sits like a golden capstone atop the physical body. The philosopher's stone. Through the staircase of the spine, energy ascends and descends, circulating, connecting the heavenly mind to the physical body. Peter knew it was no coincidence that the spine was made up of exactly 33 vertebrae. 33 are the degrees of masonry. The base of the spine, or sacrum, literally meant sacred bone. The body is indeed a temple. The human science that Masons revered was the ancient understanding of how to use that temple to its most potent and noble purpose. Unfortunately, explaining the truth to this man was not going to help Catherine at all. Peter gazed down at the grid of symbols and gave a defeated sigh.
You're right,
he lied.
There is indeed a secret staircase beneath this building, and as soon as you send help to Catherine, I'll take you to it.
The man with the tattoos simply stared at him. Solomon glared back, eyes defiant.
Either save my sister and learn the truth, or kill us both and remain ignorant forever.
The man quietly lowered the paper and shook his head.
I'm not happy with you, Peter. You failed your test. You still take me for a fool. Do you truly believe I don't understand what it is I seek? Do you think I have not yet grasped my true potential?
With that, the man turned his back and slipped off his robe. As the white silk fluttered to the floor, Peter saw for the first time the long tattoo running up the man's spine.
Dear God.
Winding up from the man's white loincloth, an elegant spiral staircase ascended the middle of his muscular back. Each stair was positioned on a different vertebra. Speechless, Peter let his eyes ascend the staircase, all the way up to the base of the man's skull. Peter could only stare. The tattooed man now tipped his shaved head backward, revealing the circle of bare flesh on the pinnacle of his skull. The virgin skin was bordered by a single snake, looped in a circle, consuming itself. At one moment. Slowly now, the man lowered his head and turned to face Peter. The massive double-headed phoenix on his chest stared out through dead eyes.
I am looking for the lost word, the man said. Are you going to help me? Or are you and your sister going to die?
You know how to find it, Moloch thought. You know something you're not telling me. Peter Solomon had revealed things under interrogation that he probably didn't even recall now. The repeated sessions in and out of the deprivation tank had left him delirious
and compliant.
Incredibly, when he spilled his guts, everything he told Malak had been consistent with the legend of the lost word.
The lost word is not a metaphor. It is real. The word is written in an ancient language and has been hidden for ages. The word is capable of bringing unfathomable power to anyone who grasps its true meaning. The word remains hidden to this day, and the Masonic pyramid has the power to unveil it.
Peter,
Malak now said, staring into his captive's eyes.
When you looked at that grid of symbols, you saw something. You had a revelation. This grid means something to you. Tell me.
I will tell you nothing until you send help to Catherine.
Malak smiled at him.
Believe me, the prospect of losing your sister is the least of your worries right now.
Without another word, he turned to Langdon's day bag and started removing the items he had packed in his basement. Then he began meticulously arranging them on the sacrificial altar. A folded silk cloth, pure white. A silver censer. Egyptian myrrh. A vial of Peter's blood, mixed with ash. A black crow's feather, his sacred stylus. The sacrificial knife, forged of iron from a meteorite in the desert of Canaan.
You think I'm afraid to die?
Peter shouted, his voice racked with anguish.
If Catherine is gone, I have nothing left. You've murdered my entire family. You've taken everything from me.
Not everything,
Malak replied.
Not yet.
He reached into the day bag and pulled out the laptop from his study. He turned it on and looked over at his captive.
I'm afraid you have not yet grasped the true nature of your predicament.
Chapter 117. Langdon felt his stomach drop as the CIA helicopter leaped off the lawn, banked hard, and accelerated faster than he ever imagined a helicopter could move. Catherine had stayed behind to recuperate with Bellamy, while one of the CIA agents searched the mansion and waited for a backup team. Before Langdon left, she had kissed him on the cheek and whispered,
"Be safe, Robert."
Now Langdon was holding on for dear life as the military helicopter finally leveled out and raced toward the house of the temple. Seated beside him, Sato was yelling up to the pilot,
"Head for DuPont Circle,"
she shouted over the deafening noise.
"We'll set down there."
Startled, Langdon turned to her.
"DuPont? That's blocks from the House of the Temple. We can land in the temple parking lot."
Sato shook her head.
"We need to enter the building quietly. If our target hears us coming..."
"We don't have time," Langdon argued. "This lunatic is about to murder Peter. Maybe the sound of the helicopter will scare him and make him stop."
Sato stared at him with ice-cold eyes.
"As I have told you, Peter Solomon's safety is not my primary objective. I believe I've made that clear."
Langdon was in no mood for another national security lecture.
"Look, I'm the only one on board who knows his way through that building."
"Careful, Professor,"
the director warned.
"You are here as a member of my team, and I will have your complete cooperation."
She paused a moment, then added,
"In fact, it might be wise if I now apprised you fully of the severity of our crisis tonight."
Sato reached under her seat and pulled out a sleek titanium briefcase, which she opened to reveal an unusually complicated-looking computer. When she turned it on, a CIA logo materialized, along with a login prompt. As Sato logged in, she asked,
"Professor, do you remember the blonde hairpiece we found in the man's home?"
"Yes."
"Well, hidden within that wig was a tiny fiber-optic camera, concealed in the bangs."
"A hidden camera? I don't understand." Sato looked grim.
"You will."
She launched a file on the laptop. "One moment, please. Decrypting file." A video window popped up, filling the entire screen. Sato lifted the briefcase and set it on Langdon's thighs, giving him a front row seat. An unusual image materialized on the screen. Langdon recoiled in surprise. What the hell? Murky and dark, the video was of a blindfolded man. He was dressed in the garb of a medieval heretic, being led to the gallows. Noose around his neck, left pant leg rolled up to the knee, right sleeve rolled up to the elbow. and his shirt gaping open to reveal his bare chest. Langdon stared in disbelief. He had read enough about Masonic rituals to recognize exactly what he was looking at. A Masonic initiate, preparing to enter the first degree. The man was very muscular and tall, with a familiar blonde hairpiece and deeply tanned skin. Langdon recognized his features at once. The man's tattoos had obviously been concealed beneath bronzing makeup. He was standing before a full-length mirror videotaping his reflection through the camera concealed in his wig. But why? The screen faded to black. New footage appeared. A small, dimly lit rectangular chamber. A dramatic chessboard floor of black and white tile. A low wooden altar flanked on three sides by pillars, atop which burned flickering candles. Langdon felt a sudden apprehension. Oh my God. Filming in the erratic style of an amateur home video, the camera now panned up to the periphery of the room to reveal a small group of men observing the initiate. The men were dressed in ritual Masonic regalia. In the darkness, Langdon could not make out their faces, but he had no doubt where this ritual was taking place. The traditional layout of this large room could have been anywhere in the world, but the powder-blue triangular pediment above the master's chair revealed it as the oldest Masonic lodge in D.C., Potomac Lodge No. 5, home of George Washington and the Masonic forefathers who laid the cornerstone for the White House and the Capitol building. The lodge was still active today. Peter Solomon, in addition to overseeing the house of the temple, was the master of his local lodge, and it was at lodges like this one that a Masonic initiate's journey always began, where he underwent the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry. "Brethren," Peter's familiar voice declared, "in the name of the great architect of the universe, I open this lodge for the practice of Masonry in the first degree." A gavel rapped loudly. Langdon watched in utter disbelief as the video progressed through a quick series of dissolves, featuring Peter Solomon performing some of the ritual's starker moments. Pressing a shining dagger to the initiate's bare chest, threatening impalement should the initiate inappropriately reveal the mysteries of Masonry, describing the black and white floor as representing the living and the dead, outlining punishments that included having one's throat cut across, one's tongue torn out by its roots, and one's body buried in the rough sands of the sea. Langdon stared. Am I really witnessing this? Masonic initiation rites had remained shrouded in secrecy for centuries. The only descriptions that had ever been leaked were written by a handful of estranged brothers. Langdon had read those accounts, of course, and yet to see an initiation with his own eyes, this was a much different story. Especially edited this way. Langdon could already tell that the video was an unfair piece of propaganda, omitting all the noblest aspects of the initiation and highlighting only the most disconcerting. If this video were released, Langdon knew it would become an internet sensation overnight. The anti-Masonic conspiracy theorists would feed on this like sharks. The Masonic organization, and especially Peter Solomon, would find themselves embroiled in a firestorm of controversy and a desperate effort at damage control, even though the ritual was innocuous and purely symbolic. Eerily, the video included a biblical reference to human sacrifice. The submission of Abraham to the Supreme Being by proffering Isaac, his firstborn son. Langdon thought of Peter and willed the helicopter to fly faster. The video footage shifted now. Same room, different night. A larger group of Masons looking on. Peter Solomon was observing from the master's chair. This was the second degree, more intense now. Kneeling at the altar, vowing to forever conceal the enigmas existing within Freemasonry. Consenting to the penalty of having one's chest cavity ripped open and pulsing heart cast upon the surface of the earth as offal for the ravenous beasts. Langdon's own heart was pulsing wildly now as the video shifted yet again. Another night. A much larger crowd. A coffin-shaped tracing board on the floor. The third degree. This was the death ritual, the most rigorous of all the degrees, the moment in which the initiate was forced to face the final challenge of personal extinction. This grueling interrogation was in fact the source of the common phrase,
to give someone the third degree. And although Langdon was very familiar with academic accounts of it, he was in no way prepared for what he now saw. The murder. In violent